This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Heat waves are crashing around the world, from Australia to Europe, from North America to the North Pole. I have collected information you need to know. Welcome to the Best of Radio EcoShock series on extreme heat. You will hear my top 15 lessons from the deadly Russian heat wave of 2010, still very important today. Plus, Australian climate blogger John Cook talks heat survival, denial, and radio silence in the media. But first we go straight to Moscow 2010 to talk with Greenpeace Russia campaigner Vladimir Chuprov. He lived it.
The Heat. Radio EcoShock. 2010.
The Arctic ice again retreated to near record low levels. In the United States, new heat records were set in many states. In fact, 17 different countries set all-time heat records this past summer, from Latin America through Africa and the Middle East to Russia itself. In Pakistan, floods beyond imagination created the world's largest humanitarian disaster. But the harbinger, the messenger from the future, took the Russian people into uncharted hell. Moscow, at the latitude of Alaska, boiled in the weather of Cairo, while grasping smoky air equivalent to 2 packs a day of cigarettes for every man, woman, and child. Russian leaders, who bragged global warming would be good for that northern country, got a taste of the coming century. We know for certain that this is the future. That is the coming century as temperatures climb, as the greenhouse atmosphere thickens, with the exhaust of our fossil civilization. Let us see what we can learn together about how people and governments act under stress, about our vulnerabilities, about our chances of survival. To begin, we'll go straight to Moscow, talking with Vladimir Chuprov of Greenpeace Russia. Are you interested in your food supplies? We'll squeeze in clips from a press conference with Lester Brown on the Russian grain export ban and the impact of climate on world food stocks. Can we even comprehend these grand events, these warning signs? I'm Alex Smith, and let's get started.
This is a serious abnormality. The Russian Weather Service has never measured such temperatures in Moscow in July. According to our calculations, it hasn't even reached its peak yet.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. The heat, drought, and fires in Russia during the summer of 2010 were truly shocking. To make sense of this, we're joined by Vladimir Chuprov. Vladimir, were you in Moscow during the heat wave, and can you describe your personal experience of these events?
This is Vladimir Chuprov. Yes, all this summer I spent in Moscow, and 2 weeks was most difficult, as it was a smog, around-the-clock smog in Moscow. Just to explain you, it was smelling with fire, so with temperature plus 40 degrees Celsius, which is absolutely untypical for Moscow, which is 20 degrees above the typical temperature this time. The visibility in the street, this distance of visibility was about 200 meters. People walking in the street with masks, not all of them, but a lot. And in a few hours of walking the street with masks, the mask is becoming brown. The air was full of carbon monoxide, which caused a lot of deaths, and the death rate in Moscow decreased twice. So it was quite horrible. So people waiting all the time, so it was impossible to open windows around the clock, especially in the night, as then the smoke get to the flat, inside. So it was very extreme, especially for children and the people having disease, blood and lung disease. So all the people had shock, as it was quite untypical, and people were not ready for such extreme conditions, weather conditions. And psychologically, it was very frustrating, as people understood they can do nothing in this situation, because the power, the Ministry of Emergency Situation, who was in charge for firefight in this pit box near Moscow, they could do nothing. And it was a situation when the human being could not control the nature processes. which was very unusual and typical, and it showed that sometimes that the humankind, it coming to end, so it cannot control anything in this planet. So psychologically, it shaked Russian public, Russian society. As a result, according to the last poll opinion results, showed that the number of people believing to climate change and recognizing the climate change as a serious problem created by humankind increased from 20% to 28%. For Russia, it's a real jump up in understanding this problem. You should know that the Russian public as well as political elites is quite skeptical towards the climate change issue, things like carbon emissions, climate change effects, etc., etc. So for Moscovites, for majority of Russian people, it was real shock, and people public opinion was shaped.
I'm wondering whether the Russian press is part of the factor in not preparing people for the possibilities of what can really happen under climate change.
It was very, very interesting experience. Yes, the people were not really prepared for such a climate change. As in the previous time, the Russian authorities, the highest politicians, they said they are in favor for climate change as it's very beneficial for Russia, as it will open the Arctic shore for oil drilling, it will create better conditions for agriculture, etc. But this summer showed that it's wrong. It's wrong, and it's brought real results and showed real impacts, negative consequences of climate change for the community, for the people.
What about the personal experiences? Well, the effects of this outside Moscow, we had a lot of publicity here in the West about the smog and people wearing masks, as you said, but it seemed we had much less coverage about the fact that villages burned down and people had to be evacuated and what was happening out in the hinterland, so to speak.
Yeah, well, we can say that Russia consists of two parts, the Moscow and the rest of Russia. It's quite bad, as all the policy of Russia depends on the opinion of Moscovites, people living in Moscow. But yes, the people outside of Moscow were damaged and suffered by these heat waves and droughts, as officially 50 people killed in these fires. About 100 villages were evacuated. Thousands and thousands people lost their homes, and now they're living in the hostels, in the hotels. So this is real strategies for 1,000 families living outside, who live near forests, and now they're damaged by these fires. A lot of human stories we learn in media this time. Sometimes these stories are quite horrible. Not all these stories and information we know we received through the official federal channels, TV channels, which are monopolized by the Kremlin. A lot of stories when firefighters didn't protect people, but they protect houses and buildings of oligarchs. A lot of stories when people asked firefighters to come and to help them, but they didn't have good enough equipment to help people. You should know that in Russia, 2 years ago, the firefight system was abolished and all these functions were handed to provincial level where they do not have any resources to handle this system. And the firefight system mostly fitted to work with the fires in the cities, in infrastructural sites and objects. So in this case, we saw a lot of stories and information for analysis. What the system? How it cannot protect people? How people had to protect themselves? So these fires this summer showed that the potential for volunteers movement in Russia is quite high, and people reacted immediately to call to people who ask this help. But another side of this medal, the government, the state, could not organize this activity. So people self-organized, they collected all the stuff, all the money, equipment to fight fire, etc., organized these fight fire brigades. But the state even didn't provide them with information how to operate, where to go, or even sometime they disturbed to them. So it was quite a lot of human stories around this fire this summer.
And I think that there will be comparisons to the U.S. Government's failure to respond to the Katrina situation after that terrible hurricane hit New Orleans. Well, another thing that I think is different here about this situation is in Europe, when they had the terrible heat wave in 2003, it came after they had managed to harvest their wheat and their grains, whereas in Russia it was right at harvest time, and there was a huge impact, as we know, on the grain situation in Russia. Can you talk just a little about that?
Yeah, the two sectors, economical sectors, mostly damaged due to these heat waves are agricultural and forest sectors. In agricultural, the official economical loss is about $1 billion equivalent, U.S. dollars equivalent. In forest, it's much higher, it's few billion dollars, U.S. dollars, direct economical loss equivalent. But according to some independent economists, the loss is a dozen times higher, which could reach 10, 15 billion U.S. dollars for the whole Russian economy, mostly for forestry and agriculture. In agriculture, Russia this summer lost 11 million hectares of the fields, where Russia lost about 20% of its crops, and it brought to the situation where when Prime Minister Putin decided to shut down the crop export, Russian export, to international markets. We checked international markets as well. In forestry, Russia lost about 5 million hectares of forests. Not all of them were burned down, but as minimum 20-30% did. So it's a real impact for the forestry sector as well. As well as two farmers who lost these harvests, and now they're seeking the support from the state. The good news is that the state is going and promised to provide financial support to the farmers suffered by these heat waves. And another problem we discovered for agriculture, for example, is insurance system. We understood, and it's very obvious, the existing insurance system do not have enough potential to cover such extreme climate weather conditions, such consequences for agriculture, for example, which means that the humankind system to prevent or to adapt, financially adapt to climate change is not enough answer for such extreme change in climate conditions.
And I'm sure that will be the situation again here in North America. This is Radio EcoShock. Our guest is Vladimir Chuprov, a climate and energy campaigner with Greenpeace in Moscow. Vladimir, in the past, you have spoken out against shipments of nuclear materials to Russia. The recent fires revealed more dangers to this whole nuclear project, from the so-called secret cities and maybe even radioactivity from the Chernobyl accident. Please tell us about the nuclear risks posed by these forest fires.
These fires, this hot summer of 2010, discovered another disadvantage of Russian economy, of Russian nuclear industry, Russian nuclear sector. These fires brought to the risk set of risks of Russian nuclear power plants, as well as a nuclear facility presented by a dozen so-called closed military cities where they develop nuclear technologies, both civilian and military ones. These risks are associated with failure, the accidents connected with the electric system. This summer, as minimum one reactor shutdown was recognized as a result of overheating of one of the transformers at one nuclear power plant in Russia. Besides that, about dozen disconnecting of cable, electric cable, connecting nuclear power plants with the grid. They're disconnected, which created some troubles for reactor operating. As well as a heat wave created problem for cooling system, as you understand, you know that the typical Russian reactors presented by boiling reactors and pressure water reactors, they need cooling water, which should have special temperature around 30 degrees above zero. this summer, sometime this cooling water had about 36 degrees, which is very sensitive for any reactor system in Russia. As a result, in one of the nuclear power plants, they had about 4 shutting downs caused by overheating transformers and fires in transformer system. Russian nuclear authorities did not recognize these shutdowns with overheating, but we understand these shutdowns could also be associated and connected with this overheating and the heat waves. As well as these stories, well-known stories around the world with the fires near nuclear cities where they also have facility operating with the plutonium, especially with the Sarov Center, which is in the middle of the Volga River, where the fires come up to this nuclear facility a few thousand meters, which is quite close, as the forest fire speed sometimes could reach 1,000 kilometers an hour. The government even decided to evacuate all this facility with nuclear materials outside of these nuclear cities, nuclear sites. So this summer we had as minimum 2 nuclear cities, nuclear centers, where they had to adopt special preventing measures to decrease risks of fire, of burning down this nuclear facility having all these nuclear materials. So this is very obvious, show that the nuclear facility, nuclear infrastructure is not adapted for coming climate change, and the negative consequences coming with this climate change, like heat waves, where this nuclear facility, which having very sensitive technology, could fail due to these high temperatures. It's very obvious.
Vladimir, there's a lot of discussion in the scientific community about whether this record heat and drought was caused by global warming. What is your opinion about this?
Greenpeace position is very clear. All this global warming, all this new weather, negative consequences, new weather conditions, all this connected and caused by humankind activity with the carbon emission discharge from oil, coal, and gas industry. But in Russia, having quite skeptical attitude to this issue, only about 30% of population recognize and believe that this is the result of humankind activity. As well as political elite, as well as scientific circles, they do not, majority of them, unfortunately, still do not trust that this is the humankind activity result. You know that Prime Minister Putin is well known with his very negative position to Kyoto Protocol, to all this scientific base, saying that this is a result of humankind activity. And till now, in Russian media, it's very obviously we see that the position of the Prime Minister, of majority of scientists, they're still quite skeptical. Even now, after this obvious results of climate change, they still did not change their position. Yeah, there was a statement from the Russian president, Mr. Medvedev, who associated and said that he said very clearly, this is a climate change and this is a humankind activity. But this is the single voice of one person, which is seen in the voices of scientists who saying that this hot summer is a result of climate weapon of United States America having special antennas and stations in Alaska and creating this weather in Central European part of Russia. Or this is a solar activity linked with the solar cycles. Or this is just moving the center of magnet field of the Earth. I personally analyzed the public, the media, and from 10 interviews of scientists explaining such a conditions, weather conditions in Russia, only one scientist said that this is the result of carbon emission discharge into the atmosphere, which is very clearly shown that Russia is still a castle of skeptical attitude, the state which will not believe to climate change till the end of the day. That's the bad news. But the good news, this summer, we saw some trends like a statement from President Medvedev, like a change of public opinion, which jumped from 20 to 28% people believing that this is humankind activity result. Prime Minister Putin asking this question, now he has kind of, now he's tried to understand for himself. Maybe he was wrong saying that it's not, it's just natural cycle. Maybe it's not. So, yeah, we have quite interesting tendency, and let's see next year how this public and elite opinion will be changed.
Well, thank you so much, Vladimir. And I want to say, reporting from Moscow, our guest has been Vladimir Chuprov. He's the head of the energy unit at Greenpeace Russia. Download this free interview at ecoshock.org and find out more from Greenpeace at greenpeace.org/Russia. Thank you, Vladimir.
Thank you, Alex, and thank you, Canada.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Whether or not the Russian firestorm was directly caused by climate change, it is a hard lesson on what we can expect from the future. Here are just a few of the issues stirred up by the heat, the smoke, and the drought, and the fires. Learn what you will from these 15 warnings.
Number 1.
Fatalities from heat and smog caused the death rate to double in Moscow. Large cities can be attacked by climate change to become deadly traps.
2.
An estimated 2,000 Russians drowned trying to escape the heat. Some died in drinking fountains. Some drank too much alcohol trying to cope with the heat and stress.
3.
The fires revealed the extreme and nearly uncontrollable dangers posed by climate change to nuclear facilities, both power reactors and military bases. Think upon that.
Number 4.
Many people tried to leave the big city, Moscow, but were prevented by smoke-closed roads and airports. Subways became dangerous. Traffic accidents and fatalities went way up. Essential goods, including food and medical supplies, couldn't get through. Transportation systems break down.
5.
The number of homeless people grew as villages were burned out.
6.
Peat fires went up to 12 feet underground and are expected to burn until winter.
7.
Crops die. 1/5 of the Russian grains were lost, exports banned, and international wheat prices rose. In the future, grain importers like the North African nations may starve. Let's take a few minutes from our countdown to listen to this press conference with Lester Brown. He's the founder of World Watch and founder of Earth Policy Institute. His latest book is Plan B 4.0, Mobilizing to Save Civilization. I recorded his web conference for journalists in August. Lester Brown has been tracking the world's grain supplies for decades.
Another thing that I've learned, at least from this experience, is how lucky we have been that this heat wave was in Moscow and not in Chicago or Beijing. I say that because Russia produces at most 100 million tons of wheat. Even if it loses 40% of the harvest, which it's close to doing now, it would be a loss of 40 million tons in the world grain harvest. But if Chicago were to have a July with average temperatures 14 degrees above the norm, the U.S. could lose half of its grain harvest. The U.S. harvests about 400 million tons of grain a year. 300 million of that is corn, most of it grown in the Midwest. Chicago is at the heart of the U.S. corn belt. 50% of 400 million tons would be 200 million tons. But even 150 or 100 million tons would be an enormous setback for a world where carryover stocks are right on the edge of what we consider to be secure. Or we could look at Beijing. Beijing is near the heart of the North China Plain, which produces half of China's wheat and a third of its corn. China, like the U.S., produces 400 million tons of grain per year. A heat wave in the North China Plain could easily cut that harvest by 100 million tons, maybe by 150 or more. What I draw from this is that we have to take global warming far more seriously than we are now doing as a society. If this teaches us anything, it is that we need to cut carbon emissions and cut them fast. We need to cut them fast before climate change spirals out of control. Because if we reach that point, then intense heat waves such as the one that's taken over Moscow, and indeed much of Western Russia, over the last 7 weeks, could be occurring more frequently and in more dangerous places in terms of world food security. I've mentioned Chicago and Beijing. I could mention other places. But to anyone who's prepared to think about it, this heat wave centered around Moscow has to be a wake-up call for the world. And we need to do something about climate change and do it quickly.
That was Lester Brown, author of Plan B 4.0, Mobilizing to Save Civilization. That's a good idea. Find out a lot more at earthpolicy.org. Now we continue with lessons for the future from the grim heat wave and firestorm in Russia during the summer of 2010.
Number 8.
Home gardens, community gardens, and survival gardens died. Beyond certain limits, plants cannot cope with the hotter climate and drought. Survivalists should begin testing their varieties and their strategies for cooling plants and watering them, or consider relocating to a microclimate regulated by the ocean or other large bodies of water.
Number 9.
Mobile conditioners sold out within 3 weeks, just as the heat set in. Many Moscow-based companies failed to foresee this heat, and they didn't want to fill their warehouses because of the crisis.
In a situation where no amount of money can buy you a gulp of fresh air, emergency centers are receiving thousands of calls from people suffering from heat stroke and sunburn.
People with lung diseases will find it hard, of course, so it'd be better to take them somewhere where there's no smoke. Another option would be to buy them a respiratory mask. They sell them in pharmacies.
Natalia Noikova, RT, Moscow.
Fans, air conditioners, and inflatable pools sold out very quickly. Money could not buy a cool place or fresh air. Air conditioners may be useless if the power goes out. Consider your tools.
10.
Some wealthy Russians were able to get out, including government officials. With the poor stuck and dying, class stress or even violence is possible during extreme climate events. Think New Orleans under Hurricane Katrina.
11.
The electric grid is strained and power lines burned down, including those coming from nuclear power stations. Brownouts and blackouts are likely in the future, even in countries like Great Britain or America.
Number 12.
People suffer extreme psychological stress. Will your baby, grandma, or asthmatic husband be okay? Are you afraid to go out for work or supplies? Will crime and violence flare in the day-after-day relentless heat? Do people come to fear the weather? What are the long-term mental health risks?
Of when the fire started, it was literally just a wall of fire as tall as the trees. It was terrifying. And they said that it all happened in almost a matter of seconds. There was almost literally nothing people could do. The fire spread from the trees to the houses, burning them down in seconds. People losing everything that they've been accumulating for their entire lives. Now they don't know what to do, how to start over again. And this, of course, is just one of the villages in Russia where such a terrible thing has happened all across the country, with the fires ravaging central Russia for over a month. Thousands of people have been left homeless.
13.
Even more carbon was released into the atmosphere. Global warming will feed more global warming. The Russian fires released millions of tons of carbon from the forests into the sky. The black particles swirled up into the international Arctic, darkening snow, hastening more melting. Brown clouds traveled as far as Beijing.
14.
The economic costs continue to mount for Russia. Forest jobs lost, workers don't show up, expensive firefighting and restoration costs, roads wiped out, crops wiped out, including orchards, farm equipment, and buildings. In Russia, the loss is estimated at least 1% of the GDP.
And number 15.
Public anger mounts, and big government often fails to handle anything with competence. Regime change, as we may yet see in Pakistan after the floods, is always possible after major climate hits. The long-term impact on public confidence is unknown. Governments may swing to authoritarian forms or break down into smaller states or even anarchy. The only way to control our path toward the future, to limit the horror of these trends, is to control our carbon emissions and other greenhouse gases. The alternative, as Climate Progress blogger Joe Rome says, is hell and high water.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio. For the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. This is a Radio EcoShock special on extreme heat. My best interviews as climate change locks in. From Moscow, Associated Press reporter Simon Schuster reported this historic moment, quote, at a meeting of international sporting officials in Moscow on July 30th, Russian President Dmitry Medvedev announced that in 14 regions of the country, quote, practically everything is burning. The weather is anomalously hot, end quote. Medvedev announced, quote, what's happening with the planet's climate right now needs to be a wake-up call to all of us, meaning all heads of state, all heads of social organizations, in order to take a more energetic approach to countering the global changes to the climate, end quote. A former employee of Forest Company International Paper, Medvedev was instrumental in dismantling the forest monitoring system that could have helped save costs, lives, and the forests. In 2009, Medvedev announced Russia would increase their warming gases 30% by 2020. Previously, President Medvedev had described global warming as, quote, some kind of tricky campaign made up by some commercial structures to promote their business projects, end quote. What else could the head of one of the world's largest fossil fuel exporters say? We can expect the same denial and obstruction from Canada for the same reasons. Ditto Australia. And like Russia, parts of Canada are burning every summer. We can say that the very purpose of our lives now is to help move carbon from deep in the earth into the sky. That's what our economy is about. That is what we do every day, you and I. We buy a product, and that moves all the carbon from extraction of raw resources through production and shipping, on the way to the landfill or incinerator, on the way to its ultimate destination, the atmosphere. Almost everything we want and do is part of this vast system of greenhouse gas production. We are the greenhouse makers. Our children will sweat it out in the world we leave them, unless we find a better way. You are tuned to the best of Radio EcoShock series on extreme heat.
When Heat Kills, Australia's John Cook, Radio EcoShock, June 2010.
What if Earth becomes too hot for humans to function outside? Science fiction or real science? Let's investigate with Australian blogger John Cook. His well-known blog is called Skeptical Science. John studied physics at the University of Queensland, Australia. He's not a climate scientist, but he relies on peer-reviewed papers by others. Like many of us, John was drawn to a startling new paper recently published in PNAS, The Proceedings of the National Academy of Science. It combines work by an Australian, Dr. Stephen C. Sherwood, from the University of New South Wales, and an American scientist, Matthew Huberb, from Purdue Climate Change Research Center. Sherwood and Huberb investigated the upper limits of human survival in a warming world. Their paper is called An Adaptability Limit to Climate Change Due to Heat Stress. So, John Cook, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me.
Why is this scientific paper important to the rest of us?
I guess one of the key results is, and I get this on my website a lot, is people say, well, no matter how hot it gets, you know, we can adapt. We can, you know, we'll get used to it, or we'll, turn up the air conditioner or something. But what the paper finds is there is a limit on what we can adapt to, and the human body needs to be warmer than its environment to cool down. So once the temperature gets over a certain point, the body just can't cool down. And at that point, you know, we can go through hypothermia or heat stroke, and, you know, health issues become important.
You know, it's strange that we go through so much education, and yet many of us don't really know how our body works, you know, what temperature our skin needs to be and why perspiration is there. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, I'm not a medical expert either, but I can give you the basics of it. Like our inner body needs to be regulated at, I think it's around 37 or 39 degrees, and so in order for our body to release heat, the skin temperature needs to be at about 35 degrees. So for that to happen, the air temperature needs to be at a cooler than that, but also what's important is the humidity. You'll find if you're in dry air, the body can cool down easier because it's easier for the sweat to evaporate. But if it's humid, it's harder to cool down, which I guess is when you're in a really hot, humid environment, it's just really uncomfortable. Once conditions get to the point where it's either too hot or too humid or both, and the body can't cool down, that's when the body starts to struggle.
Right. And also, there's something in the paper. We need to go and explain the difference between wet bulb temperature and the numbers that we're used to seeing on a thermometer or a weather forecast. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. So I was talking about humidity and how that changes our ability to evaporate and cool. The definition that scientists use to work out what temperature our body needs to be at is the wet bulb temperature. What that strictly means is if you took a thermometer and you covered it with like a wet cloth and it was fully ventilated, you know, there was air blowing past it, whatever temperature the thermometer gave you is a wet bulb temperature. And what the paper found is that the wet bulb temperature can get no hotter than 35 degrees. If we spend more than a couple of hours hotter than that, then you'll get hypothermia.
Right, and that's hyperthermia, listeners. We're used to hearing hypothermia for cold, but hyperthermia is we call it heat stroke as well sometimes. So the paper says we can't really go over 35 degrees in wet bulb temperature, around 95 Fahrenheit in humid conditions. But right now on Earth, we seldom exceed 31 degrees of wet bulb temperature. So, John, why worry?
Well, what the paper found was that if we experience warming of about, let me see, I think it was up to 7 degrees, like large regions of the Earth would actually become uninhabitable. We expect, you know, about maybe 1 degree over the next 50 years or so, depending on how our carbon emissions change. But as we go further in the future, that's just going to, you know, the temperature range will get a lot further than that, depending on what our carbon trajectory is now. Probably the most startling result I got from this paper was that we talk about our rising sea levels a lot and how as sea levels rise, that will make a lot of regions uninhabitable. But what this paper found was the corresponding temperature rise will make even more regions uninhabitable. So, I think heat stress is something that probably doesn't get as much attention as other issues to do with global warming. But what we're observing is there are actually more people dying, like currently, from heat stress than other natural disasters like hurricanes and floods. So, yeah, it's something that will get worse over time, but it's also something that's happening now. In fact, over the last few weeks, Pakistan and India are experiencing like record heat waves, the hottest on record. And hundreds of people are dying there because a lot of remote rural villages just don't have access to, I guess, air conditioners or ways to cool themselves down.
Right. I've been reading about that with some alarm. The latest reports I saw were well over 1,000 dead in India alone and Pakistan.
I hadn't been up there. The last couple of days, a few days ago, I saw several hundred. They said that was likely to be an underestimate because a lot of the reports hadn't come in from the remote villages.
And, of course, they don't have as tight a medical system for measuring just why did this person die. But we're also finding that certain portions of the population are more likely to die. Obviously, I think that includes seniors, but also younger children are passing away, and surprisingly, some people with mental illnesses are twice as likely to die from heat stroke.
Okay, I hadn't heard that. I read a statistic this morning. I think it was just in Australia, but it surprised me, actually. It said that about 10% of the heat stroke deaths were children, and about like 40% were elderly. But just over 50% were the like 10 to 60-year-olds. So, yeah, although obviously the elderly and the young are especially vulnerable, there was still a greater proportion were, you know, that just middle range of age. I thought it would have been more elderly, but, yeah, that statistic surprised me a little.
It surprises me, too. And I know you mentioned the map provided by Sherwood and Huberb in their study, and they say that the sort of lack of habitability of certain areas starts at 7 degrees centigrade from where we are now. But when you get around 11 or 12, they show you another map, which includes large parts of South America, big hunks of Asia, big parts of China, and Australia being totally uninhabitable for humans. They just couldn't go outside and do any work, which would include agriculture, I presume, too. So, I mean, here we have Australia maybe become uninhabitable in 200 or 300 years, and yet the country's ramping up its coal exports. Does the government or the public realize even this extreme risk?
I don't think so, no. And I think the government is more concerned about the next election cycle than, you know, conditions a century or more into the future. And that's one of the main problems, I think. It's just hard for us to imagine things that happen so far into the future.
But we have to care about whether our country will go on and our civilization will go on. This is Radio EcoShock. We are talking with John Cook, host of the blog SkepticalScience.com. John, you've accumulated a good community of commenters on your blog as well, and one entry really caught my attention about this heat situation. He said, the difficulty with air conditioning is that most household air conditioners are only rated up to about 41 degrees centigrade, some to 43 degrees, I think. When the temperature rises to 51 C for any length of time, like a summer heat wave, we'll either have to invent better air conditioners and dehumidifiers or find another way to keep cool. And he points out that's only 4 degrees C warmer than it got in the heat wave in Melbourne in southern Australia last year. So there may be limitations to that fallback strategy of air conditioning, not to mention the increased loads often lead to power failures anyway. Can you tell us something about the heat events that you have experienced in Australia in the last year or two?
Well, Australia is... We seem to be copping a lot of the global warming impacts, maybe are less than you might be experiencing over there. But in Brisbane a few years ago, we had a heat wave where about just over 20 people died. In Melbourne, or in Victoria, in the southeast of Australia, it's been hot and dry. And the result of that is that it's the bushfire conditions are like, they've had to invent a new scale because the danger has gotten so high. And, you know, we've experienced some very severe bushfires because of that, and whole towns getting gutted over the last few years. So, yeah, there's just been a gradual, I guess, evolution of more heat waves and more dire conditions.
Well, that seems to be the way it goes. I was looking at a paper or figures from the American National Center for Atmospheric Research, and they say over the past decade, daily high record temperatures in the United States outnumbered record lows by 2 to 1. So there are twice as many record highs in the last 10 years than there were lows. So record heat is becoming almost the norm. We hear it so often on the weather forecasts. Is that true in Australia too? They keep talking about new records being set?
I actually read that paper about the U.S. record highs. And at the time, I also read that a similar study is being done about analysing Australian temperature record, but I don't think it's come out yet. I imagine it probably is just based on the anecdotal evidence of what we're experiencing. But, yeah, I'm looking forward to when that paper can come out and we can see what the results say.
Well, we'll look for it. And when scientists speculate fossil fuels could drive us to the upper limits of human tolerance for heat, people who I would call deniers routinely fire back ideas like this one. They say, well, scientists can't predict the weather next week, so why should we believe anything 100 years from now? How do you answer that?
I guess comparing weather to climate is like comparing apples and oranges in one sense. And the way I understand it is think of throwing a dice. It's completely random whether you get a 1 or a 6, and you can't possibly predict the single roll of a dice. But if you roll the dice like 6,000 times, for instance, you can predict with reasonable accuracy that you're going to get 1,000 sixes and 1,000 ones. Now, with climate is essentially weather averaged over time. And while weather is random and chaotic, like the throwing of a dice, over time we can predict how it's going to behave, how the climate's going to behave. And what global warming is doing is it's like weighting the dice. Just so you weigh the dice so that you get 6 more often. What we're doing is weighting our climate so that we get record hot days more often. And as time's going on, that's what we're seeing. As that study from the US showed, we're seeing twice as many record hot days as record cold days. And that trend is actually increasing. 30 years ago, it was almost equal, the amount of hot days versus the amount of record cold days. But now it's gradually moved up to double, and it's still going upwards. Yeah, so once you average the weather out over time, we see long-term trends. And the trend at the moment is more record hot days.
I really appreciate the way you put that. I want to move to something else here. John, as I talk with climate scientists, and often after the call is finished, they'll talk to me a little more frankly even, and as I've done some research on the heat deaths, I suspect we may not reach this limit 300 years from now, but much sooner. We already face ongoing series of heat challenges like the hundreds dead in Chicago in 1995 and at least 35,000 killed by heat in Europe in 2003. And as you've said, many more have died in a killer heat wave in Pakistan and India. So I think deadly heat is already underestimated when we talk about global warming. Would you disagree with that?
That's a tough one, I guess. I was looking up some statistics on heat-related deaths, and it is tricky because while the heat waves are getting more often, I guess technology has also developed, so our ability to adapt to it has improved to some degree. So, yeah, I probably couldn't answer that definitively, like whether... the other thing is when they record a person's death, they can put different causes of death. So, yeah, I'm not 100% certain on how accurately they record the exact number of heat-related deaths.
Right.
But when we get into medical areas, it does get a little more complicated, I guess.
It is difficult. I know, for example, looking at the official reports from the French government about the deaths there, they said, well, you know, it's possible up to half of these deaths were really caused by the high ozone levels, in other words, really the smog that came out at the same time, but then the smog was worse because of the heat, so we've kind of classified that as a heat-related death. It wasn't a heat death, but heat-related. And also people sometimes come in from smog, they have heart attacks, and that's the cause of death, even though it might not have happened had they been in an air-conditioned room or someone was looking after them. So it's tough, I agree. Well, look, it isn't as though we aren't being warned by scientists or even governments. John, let me read you just a couple of paragraphs from a U.S. government website. It says, for example, by the end of this century, the number of heat wave days in Los Angeles is projected to double and the number in Chicago to quadruple if emissions are not reduced. Projections for Chicago suggest the average number of deaths due to heat waves would more than double by 2050 under a lower emissions scenario and quadruple under a higher emissions scenario. And they go on to talk about California and again, a lot of increase in their heat-related deaths. And even those numbers presume that people will buy more air conditioners and will figure out how to open windows in these closed office buildings and will adapt somewhat. They still expect the heat deaths to go up. I have heard Dr. Martin Cope of CSIRO saying that there's about 1,000 heat deaths in Australia and the heat and the smog increases that by about 20%. So it's coming, mate, but why is the public still so unaware of this growing danger? I just can't get past that.
I actually read a page on the CSIRO website earlier today about that, and they were saying that dangers to humanity, heat wave is almost considered like an ambient background danger compared to like more, I guess, vivid impacts like hurricanes and tornadoes and a twister that we had in Sydney for the first time ever last week, which got a lot of press. I guess heat waves, maybe they're not as sexy and don't get the same amount of attention. But what the CSIRO also mentioned was that the number of deaths from heat waves was equal or greater than the number of deaths from hurricanes and floods and tornadoes all combined. So I think it is something that, I only really started to become aware of it when I read the Sherwood paper and when I realised that heat stress is actually making more regions or will make more regions uninhabitable than sea level rise. That was a bit of an eye-opener for me. I always thought of sea level rise in my head as one of the primary impacts on humanity, but obviously there are a lot of different impacts from global warming, and as time goes on, we're understanding them more, and I'm becoming a bit more concerned as I learn more.
Well, me too. I was surprised. I mean, we call it global warming, and it's kind of a, well, duh. I mean, of course people may die of excess heat, but I hadn't really done the research and looked into it, and now I think this will come up as a greater public image, even though we don't find any stimulating footage of the old and the young quietly passing away from heat exposure. You know, we can't show the wrecked cars and houses, but there are definitely holes in some families where some loved ones were. Well, John, we haven't even discussed the impact of heat waves on agriculture. Last year's combination of heat and drought smashed Australia's farm production, from what I've read. Lester Brown warns that rice is already at the limits of heat tolerance, just a couple of degrees more when the plants are setting fruit, and the rice crops could fail, threatening millions with starvation. And then you have farm animals, who are mammals just like us. They're going to have the same heat problems, and they won't likely be air-conditioned, or some won't even be able to go inside. So I wonder, is it possible that these heat waves, in addition to leading to more mortality, could lead to starvation the way cold and frosts have done in the past?
I imagine so. I know that Sherwood touches on that fairly briefly in talking about how particular cattle will also be affected by it. I don't know of any studies in actual, you know, numbers on the impacts. But, yeah, it's when, I guess, climate skeptics say there's a lot of uncertainty, you know, a lot of this uncertainty can go in the other direction. There's things that we haven't even really investigated on how it'll affect us. And I guess heat waves on agriculture is one of those things where we haven't even begun to understand just how bad it could get.
Well, that's a great opening for me to ask you to describe some of your other work you do with your blog. Tell us about The Skeptical Scientist and the issues you cover.
Well, basically, what I'm trying to do is, I guess, just explain how climate skepticism misleads people. Because what I found is, as I've built up a database of skeptic arguments and then looked at what the science says about each argument, I found that what each argument does, all of them have in common this one trait, that they look at a small piece of the puzzle while neglecting the bigger picture. And the more I thought about it, the more I investigated, the more I realized it's almost inevitable that they had to do it this way, because when you look at all the evidence for global warming and that humans are causing it, there are like multiple lines of evidence showing it. And in terms of the evidence that global warming is happening, there are like tens of thousands of lines of evidence, you know, with ice sheets melting and glaciers retreating and thousands of species all over the world are migrating and just showing all these signs in every part of the globe. So we don't just have a consensus of scientists, we have a consensus of evidence. And so the only way really to deny this is to just focus on little bits of the data while ignoring the full picture. So what I'm trying to do is look at each skeptic argument and then present the bigger picture and show how each argument is focusing on just a small piece of the puzzle by putting it into context.
And I notice you've just started appearing on the new climate podcast, Irregular Climate, with Dan Mutal. What are you doing there?
Yeah, well, Dan started a podcast just a few weeks ago and was just, I guess, asking if anyone wanted to contribute among the, I guess, climate blogging community. And I thought I might just have a try at just giving one, I guess, skeptic argument debunk each week. It's the first time I've ever done any recording like that, so it was, yeah, I've just done my first one, and I have to record a second one today. I'm still deciding which argument I'm going to tackle. So that's an interesting experience, but I think podcasting is good. Like, it's just another way of communicating science, and as you say, there's a lack of awareness among the public. So I probably should put heat stress as one of the high priorities that I should cover, I guess.
Right. From Australia, we've been talking extreme heat with John Cook, host of the Skeptical Science blog at skepticalscience.com. John, thank you so much for your continuing work and the insight you've given us today.
My pleasure.
I'm Alex for Radio EcoShock. This is a Radio EcoShock special on extreme heat. My best interviews as climate change locks in. You are tuned to the best of Radio EcoShock series on extreme heat. Stay tuned next week for more power interviews on the wild heat waves striking around the world in my best of Radio EcoShock series, Extreme Heat. Get it all free at the show website, ecoshock.org. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Thank you for caring enough to listen. This is Power from Above by New England folk singer Dan Berggren.
Sinners, are you ready for a little redemption, to receive forgiveness for what we've done? The time has come to break bad habits. It's time to turn to the wind and sun. Just a little more power from above, just a little more faith, respect, and love for this old earth, our only home. It may take strength to say no to that power from below, but there's salvation in the power from above. There's a better way than barrels of oil. There's a better way than lumps of coal. There's a better way to work together. Renewable power, that's our goal. That's our goal. Just a little more power from above, just a little more faith, respect, and love for this old earth, our only home. It may take strength to say no to that power from below, but there's salvation in the power from above. What will we do for a better world? Get on your knees to hope and pray. Well, that's not enough unless we change. The judgment day is every day. Wars have been fought over who owns what. Lives have been lost and fortunes won. But you and I will someday win, cause no one owns, the wind or sun. Just a little more power from above, just a little more faith, respect, and love for this old earth, our only home. It may take strength to say no to that power from below, but there's salvation in the power from above. More power from above, just a little more faith, respect, and love for this old earth, our only home. It may take strength to say no to that power from below, but there's salvation in the power from above. Yes, there's salvation in the power from above.